Welcome to the latest edition of Cover to Cover with me, Eusebius McKaiser. And today we have an absolute treat for you. I'm going to be joined in a moment by John Carney, who has written a really stunning play as a single author, Kunene and the King. I've read this play a couple of times now. I can't wait to see it actually being performed. It is really, really amazing. And then a little bit later in the show, I'm going to do a review of an Afrikaans anthology of poetry called Oorlog by Nathan Trantaal. And it's a really special anthology because the poetry in it is written in Afrikaans. And I'm going to tell you about that much later. But for now, I'm joined by John Carney. And it really is a pleasure for the next 20 minutes or so to be in conversation with him. John, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you indeed. Thank you indeed.
First and foremost, congratulations. You've just won a hell of a lot of pounds.
Oh, yes. I was very, very fortunate that as the RSC, Royal Shakespeare Company, is celebrating 60 years. And in 60 years, Michael Billington, the critic, chose 10 plays that stood as highlights. And Kunene in the King is in that 10. When you look at that list, everybody who's starring in it is Lord so-and-so, Dame so-and-so, Duchess so-and-so. And now, on Saturday past, I was awarded the Pregnell Shakespeare Award for someone who life has been dedicated into literature and made it possible for Shakespeare to be accessible to the broader community.
Absolutely.
I'm a little chuffed.
You should be, absolutely. And it's a well-deserved recognition of your life's work. This play is really, really fantastic. And I don't know why I deserve the honor to write an introduction to it, but thank you for having asked me. And I want us to introduce the play to readers who will go out and buy it and read it. And I really hope that many departments around the country will consider prescribing it as a text work, because I think it's also one of those plays that would be fantastic to teach and through which to discuss issues that are existential but also politically interesting. Why don't we just take it from scene one?
Thank you.
Given that I have more white blood in me, I shall be Jack.
Okay.
And you shall be Linda. This is the closest I will come to ever being a production with the great John Carney.
Okay.
So the basic scene is in Killarney, I'll have you know, and that's where I live, and I'm Jack, and unfortunately, I am in desperate need of some care as a result of a certain condition that I find myself in, because stuff happens to bodies, and that's about as much as I'll say about the basic context. So I'm in my flat, and then the opening scene basically starts as follows. Why should a dog, a horse, a rat have life? And thou not breathe at all. Thou'lt come no more. Never, never, never pray. Who is it? Is that Mr. Delivery? You're very early. Oh, Christ. What?
Oh, my God. Have you been robbed?
No, and I'm not about to be. Get out.
I'm the carer from the nursing agency. I've come to look after you.
And I'm supposed to believe you? Get out. Get out of my house. I'm calling the police now. I said, get out.
Look, Mr. Morris, here's your file.
Jesus, and where did you steal that?
I did not steal it. I got it from Dr. Weber. He's your doctor, isn't he? Look, name, Jack Morris. Date of birth, 030753. Profession, actor.
I don't believe this. Did you use that Google thing? You guys do your research before you rob us, don't you?
Look, here is your medication.
How do I know that it's safe to take?
Morphine, dexamethasone, domperidone, and sorafenib.
Yeah. Okay, put it on the desk. Thank you. Now get out.
Well, I'm going to have to take your pulse and blood pressure first.
You don't have to. I'm waiting for the nurse from the agency. She will do that. Sister Kun.
Oh, Sister Kun. No. I'm Sister Kunene.
I love it. I absolutely love it. The last person I want in my house is a black man. I'm waiting for a white woman, and then you arrive.
I always laugh at it, because when I wrote it, I thought he didn't get it right. They said Sister Kunene, but he heard Sister Kun.
Yes.
So suddenly he's in his house, he's elderly, he's not well, he thinks I'm delivering a pizza or something for him. This black man walks in and he says, oh my God, I'm going to be robbed. First reaction, black man, I'm going to be robbed. And I'm trying to say, look, I'm a nurse. I'm wearing a uniform. He says, where do you get that costume?
It's such a fantastic opening, because it's both a comedy of errors, and yet within 2 minutes of that scene, we are immediately in exam essay writing territory about the themes.
About the themes. Look, I had this idea. We were doing The Tempest in 2009 with Sir Anthony Sher playing Prospero. Remember, all performing at the Royal Shakespeare Company in Stratford, England. Some critic felt that I wish the roles were reversed, that he played Caliban and I played Prospero. Mm-hmm. We laughed about that. I said to him, I want to write something for the two of us. 10 years, I forgot about it. Mm. 2010, I forgot about it. 2018, we were now new, we're moving to the celebration of 25 years in our democracy. Mm. And I asked myself, what would I be celebrating 25 years? Mm. What would I say has impacted or changed or not changed my life? And then I thought about, if I asked a white person, are you celebrating 25 years or not? And that's when the idea sort of began to structure in me. Now, I needed an excuse of bringing them in the same place.
Yes.
So I decided to give him a very difficult situation. He's dying. He's dying of some disease and he needs home care because he doesn't want to go to a hospice or whatever. Then he has to live. There's a wonderful moment when he says, "Oh, I'm going to have to live with you." He says, "Well, there's a room at the back." And he says, I said, "You mean the servants' quarters?" He says, "Yeah, if you don't mind." I said, "Oh, I do mind. I'm not your domestic servant. I'm not your gardener. I'm your carer. I'm going to live in the house." Then he says, "Okay, you can go." I said, "Then I'm going back to Soweto." Then he realizes, no, he needs me. So is it that need that locks them together? The few lines you quoted in the beginning are from King Lear. Mm. And Lear does not understand when the life is ebbing out of his daughter. Mm. There's the, my lord, the dot Cordelia. And then he says, how can a rat, a mouse, a horse have life and thou hath not? Mm. And that was watching death process. Mm.
You know, there's so many layers to that. For me, the first one, as you know, that fascinated me and that I spoke about in the introduction to your text is, and Sisonke Msimang focused on this in her brilliant Ruth First lecture many years ago. Mm. What are the requirements, the deep requirements of friendship? And there's an intimacy between the two characters that develops over time. But my reading, and it's just one reading of the play, is that they never become friends. The intimacy, although there's conviviality, although he eventually even travels to Soweto, where Kunene lives in his flat, and that's a wonderful moment of leaving literally and figuratively Kalani to go and see the other side. They never really become friends, do they? And it speaks to the fact that we often don't invest deeply enough cross-racially in getting to know each other. We may be going to Moyo with other staff mm-hmm. from your company for the end of year function and you laugh, but you go your separate ways. And I think what your play does, amongst many things, and I want you to meditate on this, is that it puts the spotlight on how difficult it is to forge authentic relationships and how much in South Africa we get away with having conversation, but not necessarily deep relationships being established.
It's like an arranged marriage. And there were some fantastic, the parents agree, it's getting old, get married, we've chosen the wife. It's like ukuthwala in isiXhosa, whereby we like that young girl because the family is rich or the family has a status within the community and the poor young girl is brought over. It's like what my mama used to say to some of my sisters, and that you will learn to love him. I mean, I didn't even know your father when I married him, but I love him now, and we don't have the time to invest initially. So when Jack and Moore and Lunga come together, it's a South Africa's arranged social relationship. Of course, we've done truth and reconciliation. We've even been called the Rainbow Nation. We're talking about reconciliation, social cohesion, all those wonderful words. But now I try to put them in practice. And say, all right, let's live together. Mm. Let's find each other. Mm. Save only, because it would break up this thing, anytime What keeps it together is the need, that loneliness of wanting another human being, another feeling of someone is observing me, someone is looking at me, and someone sees me. And in the beginning, Jack doesn't see Lunga. Absolutely. He sees help.
Absolutely.
I mean, there are moments. I remember I did a movie with Victor Melin and Marius Veres called The Steam Pig, where I'm a gardener pretending because I was a cop. The white people are talking about murder and plots of murder, and I'm next to the table because I don't exist. And that's what the maid is, the domestic servant is. So when they come together, he talks about his life, but not to me, but using me to receive. But the thing that binds them is their love for Shakespeare.
Yes.
And of course that this white actor is hoping that he'll get a remission on his little sickness and will be able to do this role. So that's what, and he's amazed at, what does it, Bantu guy from Soweto in Orlando, know about Shakespeare? And he finds that he knows a little more than I do.
Absolutely.
As though I'm the classical best Shakespearean actor in South Africa.
I want to come back to some of that, but I want to give our viewers a taste of another theme that you've just alluded to that is massive in this play, which is illness. And you've had to deal with illness with a sibling in your own life. And the coincidence with the play's prominence, the text coming out, you have to think again about that and what it's meant in a close relationship of your own and how that's connected to the text. But speak to me about that. I mean, it's really interesting how our relationship with our body can be completely thrown off when you get a diagnosis like cancer.
Oh, you know, I was doing The Lion and the Lamb at the Market Theatre just before I started writing. My younger brother was 73. He's Reverend Kani. We always said that my father takes care of the traditional ancestors. Right? And my father said he is now reverend because he'll deal with God and heaven on our behalf of the Kani clan. And I would ask him a question about, there's somewhere in the Bible that Judas said to Jesus, where is it? He would say, King James, there. And I said, okay, there's somewhere this. And they would say, then he asked me, what are you doing? I said, no, I'm writing this play. It's about this guy who needs help. He's suffering from liver cancer, blah, 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 blah. Okay. He said, oh, you always choose these difficult subjects. I said, no, it's something I'm mulling over. So I forgot about him. I now come back from Stratford 2019. That was 2018. 2019 March, he calls me. He says, you're not going to believe it. I'm just from the doctor. I've been diagnosed. Liver cancer, stage 4. I stopped. You know, the first reaction, by the time I put down the phone, he's dead. You know, in fact, African people don't even say cancer. They have so many, that disease. It's never mentioned. It's that disease. I always got suffering from, you know, Lantinkul or the Big C. So I couldn't understand that. I couldn't mull it in my mouth. And I hoped in my heart. And I was very happy that I spoke about the play before he was diagnosed. So he must know that I'm not writing about him. So when we opened in London, knowing now that these days were really numbered, I could stop in the performance in the West End. Because every word that comes out of my mouth, and especially out of Jack, his experience of I'm dying, and slowly denial, acceptance, anger, slapping on help and family, the hatred and the everything, because when people are sick, they hit the family. They're actually trying to say, see me, feel me, I'm nervous, I'm afraid. And when I had to understand that, I had a lot of research. Catherine Mannix in England is a known guru on the process of death. She sat us down with Tony Shea and Janice Honeyman, great director, and we talked about this process. What happens to the body? What happens to the mind? When does the mind give up or accept? When does the body deteriorate? In what form? Because Tony wanted to be so accurate, and we were also nervous about offending. Cancer is a huge situation. There's someone in the audience every night who's gone through that experience. Then I visited hospices to see the care. And this wonderful woman said, you build a relationship with the person who's coming in. You give them your heart, you open, and you embrace them, that you do understand. You know our job is not to say you are not going to die. Mm. Our job is to make you live well while dying. That's what she said to me, to live well while dying. Mm. And then I said, what happens then when the patient dies? He says, you wash your hands. You get home and you change your uniform and you get back to the next arriving patient. How does it impact on you? It says, look, there are little things in your soul that you remember certain faces. But this is now, the play is being performed. Mm. And that was for me the greatest sort of moment, is to find someone sitting in the auditorium, not leaving, and tell me, I just buried my wife 2 weeks ago. Someone who was 91, who grew up in Durban and left in the 1960s, sat down there. He said, I'm waiting for you to say thank you. I'm also dying.
Don't tell me that. Don't tell me that.
Wow. But that was the power of this play. Mm. And having chosen Sir Anthony Sheyatoni, South African from Cape Town, an incredible human being. Mm. What a brilliant actor. Mm. Man, that man unpacks the text and wants to ask me a question, what word by word, not the sentence, the word by word by word. And with Janice Hahnemann, I call her the crapping director. She craps all the time. She craps and craps and craps. What did you mean by this? And you go back and you back and you back and you back. You mean things like, South Africans view South Africa differently. I may celebrate 25 years of democracy. I'm not oblivious on the mess of wrong things. Yeah. But if you take me back, I'm 78 years old. Mm. I was 51 years when I voted for the first time. Mm. In fact, I got very angry after voting. Mm. I thought it was going to be difficult to get rid of this thing, to get to liberation. To put a piece of paper in a stupid box and walk out, I'm now free. Mm. I didn't clap any boor. I didn't kick anybody. I didn't take somebody's things that were belong to me. Just a little cross on a face I know. And that made me very angry.
Are there any of my white colleagues here that want to volunteer for a club? John, can we just go back to one moment before we leave it? Obviously, being the consummate professional that you are, you know how to get into performative mode. But was it difficult to be in that mode when the text is suddenly so close to home?
You use life experience for an actor, for a performer, for an artist. Your life is a reference library. In order to understand the process that the artist goes through, you go through that moment. I remember a young actor asking me, Dada, there's this scene that I have to cry every evening. Sometimes I just can't. How can you help me? I said, then when you cried the first time, what did you do? He said, I thought about being brought up by my grandmother in Mapetla or in Soweto. And when she died and they took me to see the body in the coffin, I cried because I couldn't believe she's gone. Mm. So that's what I was using for that moment. And I said, it's going to be very difficult to kill your grandmother every night for you to cry. So what we're going to do, let's go to that moment. Describe it to me and let your emotions flow. And it was describing the tears were running. And I said, then take a Polaroid snap. Take a photograph of it. And then when you perform, get there. Sure. Not to the grandmother, get to the moment. So that then helps me in my any character I play, is that I use the real reference. But then in performance, I've got the picture. I know where I'm going. And in fact, it's very important that you don't show that pain. The audience feel that pain. Then they cry. But if you cry before them, oh, here comes Snot and Tran. This play is very serious. No, you stay straight. In comedies, you know, when people have those, like the Laurel and Hardys and all that, it's the most plain, straight comic. that's more hilarious, who is oblivious of what the mess around him. So those you use as reference points.
The final part of the play, we see Jack comically on public transport going into Soweto, and he ends up basically in the abode of the person that has been inside his domestic space all along for most of the play. Without being didactic, just tell me a little bit what the thinking was around that part of the plot. It was the part of the plot that I found the least corresponding to reality. I wish more white people would take a taxi to Soweto.
If you look at King Lear, after the daughters disappoint him, having given them everything, Goneril and Regan, they throw him out, and he wanders in a storm. And it's that huge storm that makes his mind understand his loneliness and his uselessness and what age has done to him, and the fact that loss of power and the deep disappointment of children that he had given, looked after. Now, I wanted an equivalent of that storm. And I thought, get Jack in the bloody taxi to Soweto. Then we have the Saturday afternoon, the 4 o'clock afternoon, Johannesburg thunderstorms to replicate that moment. Jack gets into the storm in the taxi and realizes I'm white, but he's amazed at the generosity. He learns about being human and humanity. And then I wanted to give him that experience. Do you remember when that time, I think it was Transvaal against some team, the Blue Bulls, being in Orlando Stadium. And they were amazed that people volunteered to look under their cars instead of taking them and stealing them and killing them. This image, to get him through that was to go through the storm. And then when he arrives, suddenly the roles are changed. It's my house, and there is no Sister Kunen in this house. You are my guest, so you're not going to talk about your arrogance from Kilani.
Okay.
Now you're in my house. That was the purpose.
Yeah, John, we only have 3 minutes left. Okay. I want to talk about the writing process. I know, because we've had multiple conversations, that one of the things that mean a lot to you is the fact that this is a single author play. Your work is on many South African plays, sometimes less visible than it ought to be. How important is it that you wrote this play, John Carney? Not in footnotes, not in collaboration, as a single author. Speak to me about that, and then in the remaining 1.5 minutes, just tell the viewers a little bit about Zeyks Mda playing the role of an English teacher with your text.
It's so easy, South Africa in the 70s and the 80s, for some reason we workshopped every production. The old idea was hit the government, hit the racial laws. So there was that. And then 1994, we found ourselves without a subject because we were now part of the ruling class, part of the problem, and the solution must come from us. The biggest fear for me as a dramatist is the blank page. You sit there and you look, do I write scene one of what? Do I give a title? No. Do I start the story? So that process for me gets easier if the beginning point is my own truth. And it is what I feel as John Carney. I may call the character Lunga or Sipo or whatever, but the beginning point is me. And then I just open up and it flows. And I write by hand, because the computer keeps telling me that glad is better than hope, than happy, and I hate that. And it underlines the words. I don't know whether I've spelled it incorrectly. Why is it underlining it? It distracts me. So you finish that process, and I do not read until I complete. When I feel there's nothing more to say, I leave it there, and I go away and go back to it. Now, this is me interrogating me and opening to me my vulnerabilities, my little hohojis, my little anger, my little misunderstandings are all put on the paper. And that is what I do. So I'm telling you about...
30 seconds. Just tell us about Zeyks.
Zeyks Mda and I are wonderful good friends. I sent a play to him to read. And just to make a comment, I like him very much. Now the script comes back, like it's from my high school English teacher. with a red ballpoint pen surrounding things, talk too much and go there, get to the point. Another one that to the person. I got so angry at him. So what the hell, what does he think he is? I didn't look at that corrections. I left it there. And a month later, I went back to rewrite without looking what he said. And I found that 90% of his comments implemented themselves. Beautiful. In the writing.
John, you've been an incredible gift to the world, and you're always generous as well. Brilliant people aren't often as nice as you are. Thank you both for your output and for your kindness, and thanks for coming on the show.
And thank you for writing the introduction.
It's only a pleasure.
I'm famous. I got Eusebius MacIver to write the intro.
I think he did far more for my CV than he did for yours. Well, that's it for this particular interview. There's more for the show. I'm going to do a review in a couple of minutes, but in the meantime, please go and buy this book. If you're an English teacher, a head of department provincially, you want to prescribe it as a set work, but don't be reductive in the interpretations of it. Let the children make up their own minds about it. But Kunene and the King is a South African gem, and I hope we will all support it.
It's that time of year when the homebrew campaign kicks off, and these are some of the titles you should be looking out for. Listen to Your Footsteps is author Kojo Bafu's latest book. It's a collection of edgy essays and reflections on what it means to be a contemporary African man and the hard work that goes into being a son, a husband, a father, and a brother. Bafu enjoys an interesting heritage with his roots in Ghana and Germany, although he was raised in Lesotho and moved to South Africa in his late 20s. In recent years, Bafu's earned a reputation as a thinker who chooses to explore perspectives outside the categories society seeks to foist on us. And then there are two books which delve into life on the Cape Flats, each approaching the milieu from a different perspective. Shanna Fife offers a personal story of survival amid an environment that fueled rape, drug abuse, and depression. Her reflections on her community, motherhood, and marriage are frank and unfettered in this autobiographical novel, Ochat, From a Hoe into a Housewife, and Then Some. Despite the heavy subject matter, Fife handles it all with the distinctive humor that has become a hallmark of her writing. Ivan Johnson offers his own perspective in But He Speaks So Well, Memoir of a South African Identity Crisis. Here, Johnson seeks to explore the identity crisis he suffered growing up on the Cape Flats during apartheid. Johnson recounts the effects of his childhood marginalization as a mixed-race South African and shares his yearning for a sense of belonging as a young adult in an alienating society where he struggled to fit in. Look out for the Homebrew Collection on Exclusive Books shelves and on exclusivebooks.com.
I'm going to be reviewing for you right now this anthology of Afrikaans poetry that's called Oorlog by Nathan Trantaal. And if you're wondering why Oorlog, as Joanne asked me, that's because you and I were taught Rian Kruiwagen in Afrikaans at school. So you're probably looking for the word Oorlog, which would be Standaard Afrikaans, which is not the Afrikaans that I speak at home. I speak what would be referred to as Afrikaaps. So this is not an Afrikaans poetry collection, it's an Afrikaaps poetry collection by a, in South African nomenclature, a colored poet who's also a columnist for Rapport and a really important social commentator. Let me read one of the poems for you, and it's called Dasi Foti. Hulle sê, 'n tikkop sal jou panty van jou lyf afsteel en dan sal jy nie eers witie. Face met die view tot 'n haai, as 'n tikkop se antwoord tot elke probleem, dan kan nie fout is nie. Gee hom 'n Gordian knot, dan sny hy die tou in twee. Of hy sal die paal met tou en aal uit die grond uit en verkoop aan jou ma. Ek het 'n lekker paal hier vir jou ma, dat se tou ook aan. Sit 'n tikkop voor die rooi see, dan roep hy twee ander tikkoppe en saam move hulle die waves na die kant toe dat die Israeliete kan deurstap. Kom ma, kom ma, ons hoor die see, dat se foutie. Sê vir 'n tikkop, as hy world peace vir jou kan reël by 4 o'clock vanmiddag, gaan jy hom 'n R25 gee. Kom hy 2 o'clock in die middag daaraan met nog 'n tikkop en world peace in 'n winkel trolley, dan sit jy daar met 'n vriende wat jy nooit gedink het jy sal ken nie. En hy gaan float weg om die draaitjie. Môre sien jy op die nuus, almal maak oorlog. Van iemand het van plek tot plek gegaan en alle liefde uit die wêreld gesteel. What I love about this collection is very simple, is that it's colored people whose lives are rendered visible in the way that we speak Afrikaans, and it is decolonizing the Afrikaans language by recognizing that there's absolutely no reason why white Afrikaans people should have a monopoly on speaking Afrikaans and writing Afrikaans. The characters in here come from my community, and they speak my kind of Afrikaans rather than trying really hard om soos Rian Kreyvagen op die Afrikaans nuus te klink. And that's really important to me because it just expands our view of who is allowed to write poetry and what can be regarded as mainstream Afrikaans poetry. All the Afrikaans poetry that you and I wrote exams about was poetry that was typically written, 99% of it, by white Afrikaans poets in this country, even though the majority are actually colored people in Gauteng and in the Western Cape who speak this language. So the question of who's Afrikaans is a very important question that gets centered in poetry. And I think the reason why Nathan Trantaal is such a refreshing and important voice is that he embodies the importance of epistemic justice for communities whose relationship with the Afrikaans language you don't find in books and in bookstores. That's it for this edition of the show. Remember to go to exclusivebooks.co.za. There you can find any one of the books we've been talking about if you want to look out for any ones that you want to buy. And remember, of course, that any past editions of the show that you've missed, just go to the YouTube channel of Exclusive Books and you can go back and enjoy some of our interviews that I have done. And watch out for the next episode, which will be hosted by Joanne Joseph.